2.1.4 Investment Companies. An investment company is a corporation or trust that pools investors' money and then invests that money in securities on their behalf. Investors are able to pool their money and have the investment company invest it based on a clearly defined objective, such as growth or income. By investing these pooled funds as a single large account, jointly owned by every investor in the company, the investment company is able to invest in many different securities and therefore reduce the overall risk associated with investing in only one or a few. These pooled investments can total hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars. They are very popular investment vehicles, as it is common for them to allow minimum investments of perhaps only $100 or even less. While investing $100 many times might not purchase a single share of stock or one bond, the ability to pool that $100 with thousands or millions of investors gives the individual investor a great advantage, purchasing power in the marketplace. Like corporate issuers, investment companies raise capital by selling shares to the public. Investment companies must abide by the same registration and prospectus requirements imposed by the Securities Act of 1933 on other issuers. Investment companies are subject to regulations regarding how their shares are sold to the public, and they are regulated by the Investment Company Act of 1940. 2.1.4.1 Types of Investment Companies. The Investment Company Act of 1940 classifies investment companies into three broad types: face amount certificate companies, FACs, unit investment trusts, UITs, and management investment companies. Summary, classification of investment companies. The three types of investment companies are face amount certificate company, management investment company, and unit investment trust, or UIT. A management investment company may be either open-end, like a mutual fund, or closed-end. If open-end, it can be diversified or non-diversified. In closed-end, it can be diversified or non-diversified. For a unit investment trust, it can be either a fixed UIT or a non-fixed UIT. Take note, variable annuities have sub-accounts that are defined as either UITs or open-end management investment companies. Face amount certificates. A face amount certificate, or FAC, is a contract between an investor and an issuer in which the issuer guarantees payment of a stated face amount sum to the investor at some set date in the future. In return for this future payment, the investor agrees to pay the issuer a set amount of money, either as a lump sum or in periodic installments. If the investor pays for the certificate in a lump sum, the investment is known as a fully paid face amount certificate. Issuers of these investments are face amount certificate companies. Very few face amount certificate companies operate today. Unit investment trusts, or UITs. A unit investment trust, or UIT, is an investment company organized under a trust indenture. Unit investment trusts do not have boards of directors. They have trustees. UITs create a portfolio of debt or equity securities designed to meet the company's objectives. They then sell redeemable interests, also known as units or shares of beneficial interest, in their portfolio of securities. Each share is an undivided interest in the entire underlying portfolio. A UIT may be fixed or non-fixed. A debt-fixed UIT typically purchases a portfolio of bonds and terminates when the bonds in the portfolio mature. An equity-fixed UIT purchases a portfolio of stocks and, because stocks don't have a maturity date, terminates at a predetermined date. A non-fixed UIT purchases shares of an underlying mutual fund. Take note, FACs and UITs are not managed. Once the portfolios are composed, they do not change. FACs and UITs do not trade in the secondary market. They are redeemable only through the issuer. Managed investment companies, closed and open-end. The most familiar type of an investment company is the management investment company, which actively manages a securities portfolio to achieve a stated investment objective. A management investment company is either closed-end or open-end. Both closed and open-end companies sell shares to the public in an initial public offering. The primary difference between them is that a closed-end company's initial offering of shares is limited. It closes after a specific authorized number of shares have been sold, and an open-end company is perpetually offering new shares to the public. It is continually open to new investors. In this section, we'll look at each. Closed-end investment companies. A closed-end company will raise capital for its portfolio by conducting a common stock offering, much like any other publicly traded company that raises capital to invest in its business. In the initial offering, the company registers a fixed number of shares with the SEC and offers them to the public with a prospectus for a limited time through underwriters. Once all the shares have been sold, the fund is closed to new investors. Many times a fund elects to be a closed-end company because the sector in which it intends to invest has a limited amount of securities available. Closed-end investment companies may also issue bonds and preferred stock. Closed-end investment companies are often called publicly traded funds. After the stock is sold in the initial offering, anyone can buy or sell shares in the secondary market, that is, on an exchange or OTC, in transactions between private investors. Supply and demand determine the bid price, the price at which an investor can sell, and the ask price, the price at which an investor can buy. Closed-end fund shares may trade above, at a premium to, or below, at a discount to, the share's net asset value, or NAV. Simply put, the fund's NAV is its assets minus liabilities. The NAV per share is the fund's NAV divided by the number of outstanding shares. Test topic alert. Closed-end investment companies are the only investment company security that trades in the secondary market. Closed-end investment companies may issue common stock, preferred stock, and debt securities. Open-end investment companies or mutual funds. An open-end company only issues one class of security, which is common stock, no preferred shares or bonds. It does not specify the exact number of shares it intends to issue, but registers an open offering with the SEC. In other words, mutual funds conduct a continuous primary offering of common stock. With this registration type, they can raise an unlimited amount of investment capital by continuously issuing new shares. When investors want to sell their holdings in a mutual fund, the fund itself redeems those shares. In this respect, mutual fund shares are like FACs and UITs in that they do not trade in the secondary market. When an investor sells shares back to the fund is redeeming the shares, the fund sends the investor money for the investor's proportionate share of the fund's net assets. Therefore, a mutual fund's capital shrinks when investors redeem shares, but so does the number of outstanding shares. The value of each share does not fall as a result of the redemption. Take note. You should understand that while mutual funds only issue common shares to their shareholders, the funds themselves can purchase common stock, preferred stock, and bonds for their investment portfolios. As noted, each fund has a stated investment objective, and which types of securities the fund portfolio purchases has largely to do with fulfilling that objective. The following summarizes the differences between open-end and closed-end fund companies. For an open-end, capitalization is unlimited, continuous offering of shares. For closed-end, capitalization is fixed, single offering of shares. For open-end, issues common stock only, no debt securities, and permitted to borrow. Closed-end issues common and preferred stock and debt securities. For open-end, shares are full or fractional. For closed-end, they are full only. For open-end, offerings and tradings are sold and redeemed by fund only, continuous primary offering, and must redeem shares. For a closed-end, the initial primary offering, secondary trading OTC or on an exchange, does not redeem shares. For open-end, pricing is NAV plus sales charge, the selling price determined by formula in the prospectus. For closed-end, pricing is CMV plus commission, the price determined by supply and demand. For open-end, shareholder rights, dividends when declared, and voting. For closed-end, shareholder rights, dividends when declared, voting, and preemptive. For open-end, the X date is set by the BOD. For a closed-end, the X date is set by the exchange, or FINRA. Variable contracts and annuities. An annuity is an insurance contract designed to provide retirement income. The term annuity refers to a stream of payments guaranteed for some period of time. That might be for the life of the annuitant, until the annuitant reaches a certain age, or for a specific number of years. The actual amount to be paid out may or may not be guaranteed, but the stream of payments itself is. Because an annuity can provide an income for the rest of someone's life, the contract has a mortality guarantee. When you think about a retiree's greatest fear, it is typically outliving their income. This product can take away that fear. Insurance companies introduced the variable annuity as an opportunity to keep pace with inflation. For this potential advantage, the investor assumes the investment risk rather than the insurance company. Because the investor takes on this risk, the product is considered a security. Individuals who are both insurance licensed and securities licensed are eligible to sell variable insurance products. The premium payments for variable annuities are invested in what is called the separate account. The separate account is comprised of various subaccounts that behave like the diversified portfolios of mutual funds. We just can't call them mutual funds. These accounts will have a variety of investment objectives to choose from, such as growth, income, and growth and income. The returns in the separate account are not guaranteed, and therefore a loss of principal is possible. If the investment manager of an insurance company is responsible for selecting the securities to be held in the separate account is directly managed and must be registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940 as an open-end management investment company. However, if the investment manager of the insurance company passes the portfolio management responsibility to another party, the separate account is indirectly managed and must be registered as a unit investment trust under the Investment Company Act of 1940. Take note. A fixed annuity differs from a variable annuity. Though both are insurance company products and both guarantee a stream of income for life, a fixed annuity simply promises a stated rate of return. Therefore, it is the insurance company who is at risk to provide the rate of return it promised. The investor assumes no investment risk with a fixed annuity. With no investment risk for the investor to shoulder, the product is not considered to be a security. 2.1.4.2 Mutual Fund Open-End Characteristics. Here we'll discuss the characteristics unique to mutual or open-end funds. A mutual fund is a pool of investors' money invested in various securities as determined by the fund's stated investment objective. Mutual funds have several unique characteristics detailed in this section. Unlike most other securities, mutual funds offer guaranteed marketability. If an investor wants to sell shares previously purchased in a mutual fund, it is the mutual fund that stands ready to buy them back. Mutual funds, therefore, are redeemable securities. You will recall that this means they do not trade in any secondary market. Each investor in the mutual fund's portfolio owns an undivided interest in the portfolio. All investors in an open-end fund are mutual participants. No one investor has a preferred status over any other investor because mutual funds issue only one class of common stock. Each investor shares mutually with other investors in gains and distributions derived from the investment company portfolio. Each investor's participation in the fund's performance is based on the number of shares owned. Mutual fund shares may be purchased in either full or fractional shares, unlike corporate stock, which may only be purchased in full shares. Because mutual fund shares can be fractional, the investor can think in terms of dollars rather than number of shares owned. Example. Suppose a mutual fund's shares are priced at $12.34 a share, and an investor wishes to invest $4,000. Given the share price and the amount the investor wants to invest, the purchase will be for 324.15 shares, or $4,000 divided by 12.34, which equals 324.15. In other words, the investor doesn't need to specify purchasing any specific number of shares, that is 323, 324, or 325 shares. Instead, the investor can simply decide on how much money she wants to invest, and however many shares that dollar amount will purchase will be the number of shares the investor will now own. An investment company portfolio is elastic. Money is constantly being invested or paid out when shares are purchased or redeemed. The mutual fund portfolio's value and holdings fluctuate as money is invested or redeemed, and as the value of the securities in the portfolio rises and falls. The investor's account value fluctuates proportionately with the mutual fund portfolio's value. Here are several characteristics of mutual funds. A professional investment advisor manages the portfolio for investors. Mutual funds provide diversification by investing in different companies or securities. Most funds allow a minimum investment, often $500 or less, to open an account, and they allow additional investment for as little as $25. An investment company may allow investments at reduced sales charges based on the amount of the investment. An investor retains voting rights similar to those extended to common stockholders, such as the right to vote for changes in the BOD, approval of the investment advisor, changes in the fund's investment objective, changes in sales charges, and liquidation of the fund. Mutual funds must offer reinvestment of dividends and capital gains at NAV without a sales charge. An investor may liquidate a portion of his holdings without disturbing the portfolio's balance or diversification. Tax liabilities for an investor are simplified because each year the fund distributes a Form 1099 explaining taxability of distributions. A fund may offer various withdrawal plans that allow different payment methods at redemption. And funds may offer reinstatement provisions that allow investors who withdraw funds to reinvest up to the amount withdrawn within 30 days with no new sales charge. This provision must be in the prospectus and is available one time only. Share classes. Investors can purchase the same underlying mutual fund shares in several ways. Generally, investors can purchase Class A shares, Class B shares, and Class C shares. The difference among these shares are how much and in what way investors will pay sales charges or loads and related expenses. In essence, these sales charges are the way the distribution services that a fund's underwriter provides are paid for. Some fund companies market their shares directly to the public without the assistance of underwriters. In these instances, the companies offer what are referred to as no-load funds, a fund with no sales charges. Class A front-end load shares. Class A shares have front-end sales charges or loads. with A shares, the sales charges are paid at the time an investor buys shares, and the sales charges taken from the total amount invested. Front-end loads are the most common way of paying for mutual fund shares. Example: suppose a fund company offers a fund with a 5% sales charge, and an investor wants to invest $10,000. Because 5% of the $10,000 investment must be allocated to the sales charge, only $9,500 is actually going to purchase fund shares. $10,000 times 0.05 equals $500 sales charge. $10,000 invested minus $500 sales charge equals $9,500 available to purchase shares. Class B, or back-end load shares. Class B shares have a back-end sales load, also called a contingent deferred charge, or CDSC. A back-end sales charge is paid at the time an investor sells shares previously purchased, has them redeemed. The sales load, a declining percentage charge reduced annually, for example, 8% the first year, 7% the second, 6% the third, is applied to the proceeds of any shares sold in that year. The back-end load is usually structured so that it drops to zero after an extended holding period, usually no longer than 5 years. At that time, the shares are converted to Class A shares, and no sales charge would be applied at the time of redemption. Take note, with Class B shares, the full investment amount is available to purchase shares, as no sales charge is applied at the time of purchase, but is instead deferred to the time of redemption. If an investor wants to invest $10,000, the entire amount is available to purchase shares. While it might seem appealing to pay sales charges later, at the time of redemption, instead of at the time of purchase, as with A shares, it must be considered that if the shares grow in value as one hopes they will, the sales charges will be paid on amounts that are greater than the amount initially invested. This means that if the shares aren't held long enough to have the sales charge dissipate to zero, the sales charge can be costly as redemptions take place over time. Class C, level load shares. Class C shares typically have a 1 year, 1% contingent deferred sales charge, or CDSC, a 0.75% 12B1 fee, fees used to promote the fund discussed later, and a 0.25% shareholder services fee. Because these fees never go away, C shares are commonly referred to as having a level load. Class C shares are appropriate for investors that have short time horizons because the annual charges make them expensive to own if investing for more than 4 to 5 years. No-load shares. As noted earlier, some companies market their shares directly to the public, eliminating the need for underwriters and thus the sales charges used to compensate them. As the name no-load implies, the fund does not charge any type of sales charge. However, not every type of fee passed on to shareholders is considered to be a sales charge. No-load funds are permitted to charge fees that are not considered sales charges, such as purchase fees, account fees, exchange fees, and redemption fees. Although a redemption fee is deducted from redemption proceeds, just like a deferred sales load, it is not considered to be a sales load as it is generally much smaller and often a fixed dollar amount instead of a percentage of the redemption. Market timing. Market timing is short-term buying and selling of mutual fund shares to take advantage of inefficiencies in mutual fund pricing. Market timing can harm long-term mutual fund shareholders because it can dilute the value of their shares. While not illegal per se, market timing is prohibited by the vast majority of mutual funds. Consider that mutual fund investments are intended to be best suited for investors with longer-term investment time horizons and in fact have sales charges structured this way. They are not intended to be investments where day trading, trading in and out of a security many times over a short period of time, or market timing should be the investment strategy of the investor purchasing mutual fund shares. net asset value, or NAV. Because mutual funds don't trade in the secondary market, the value of shares is not determined by supply and demand, but rather by formula. Everything begins with net asset value, or NAV, per share. To calculate the NAV of a fund share, the fund starts with its total assets and subtracts out its total liabilities. Total assets minus total liabilities equal total net asset value of the fund. The fund then divides the total net assets by the total number of shares outstanding. This gives the net asset value, or NAV, per share. Net asset value of the fund divided by shares outstanding equals NAV per share. Example: the ABC fund has total assets of $100 million and $5 million in liabilities. If it has 10 million shares outstanding, what is its NAV per share? Net assets, $100 million total assets minus $5 million total liabilities equals $95 million total NAV. And NAV per share, $95 million divided by 10 million shares outstanding equals $9.50 per share. The NAV of a fund share is the amount the investor receives upon redemption. It must be calculated at least once per business day. A typical fund calculates its NAV at the end of each business day. The price the customer receives is the next NAV calculated after the receipt of his redemption request. This practice is known as forward pricing. We always have to wait until the next available calculation to determine the value of shares redeemed, or, for that matter, the number of shares purchased. The purchase price of a fund share is called the public offering price, or POP. For the class of fund shares known as front-end loaded shares, it is simply the NAV plus the sales charge. NAV plus SC equals POP. As noted earlier, the sales charge is paid as compensation to the underwriters for marketing or bringing the shares to the public. As a reminder, sales charges can be levied at the time of purchase, front-end load, at the time of redemption, back-end load, over the course of ownership, level load, or there can simply be no sales charge, no load, meaning that the shares are both purchased and redeemed at NAV. The NAV changes daily because of changes in the market value of the securities in a fund's portfolio. The following summarizes which events increase, decrease, or do not affect the fund's NAV. NAV increases if the market value of securities increases, the fund receives dividends, the fund receives interest, or liabilities decline. The NAV decreases if the market value of securities declines, fund distributes dividends, the fund distributes capital gains, or liabilities increase. NAV does not change if the manager buys or sells securities, the fund issues shares, or the fund redeems shares. Mutual fund prospectus. Investors must be provided with specific information when purchasing and tracking mutual funds. Prospectus. This is the full and fair disclosure document that provides a prospective investor with the material information needed to make a fully informed investment decision. If using a prospectus to solicit a sale, it must be distributed to an investor before or during the solicitation. The front of a mutual fund prospectus must contain key information to appear in plain English in a standardized order. Information in this clear and concise format includes the fund's objective, investment policies, sales charges, management expenses, and services offered. It also discloses 1, 5, and 10-year performance histories or performance over the life of the fund, whichever is shorter. Example: if a fund has been in existence for 8 years, it will show performance for 1, 5, and 8 years. If it has been in existence for only 4 years, it will show 1 and 4 years. The delivery of any type of sales literature is considered a solicitation of sale and therefore must be accompanied or preceded by the delivery of a prospectus. Test topic alert. A prospectus may not ever be altered in any way. This means no highlighting, writing in, or taking any measure to bring attention to any specific passage or section is permitted. Summary prospectus. A mutual fund can provide a summary prospectus to investors that may include an application that investors can use to buy the fund's shares. The summary prospectus is a standardized summary of key information in the fund's full or final prospectus, sometimes referred to as the fund's statutory prospectus. Investors who receive the summary have the option of either purchasing fund shares using the application found therein or requesting a full statutory prospectus. An investor who purchases fund shares on the basis of the summary prospectus must be able to access a full prospectus no later than the confirmation of the sale. Delivery may be made online. There are some very specific requirements for a summary prospectus. The following must be included on the cover page of the summary prospectus or at the beginning of the summary prospectus: the fund's name and the class or classes of shares, the exchange ticker symbol for the fund's shares, and if the fund is an exchange-traded fund or ETF, identification of the principal U.S. market or markets on which the fund shares are traded. A legend must appear on the cover page that refers to the summary nature of the prospectus and the availability of the fund's full or statutory prospectus. The legend must provide a toll-free number to request paper delivery of the prospectus or a website where one may be downloaded. Additionally, the summary must provide specific information in a particular sequence, such as investments, risks and performance, fee tables, investment objectives, investment strategies and any related risks, the portfolio holdings as well as details regarding management, shareholder information, and any financial highlights. Statement of Additional Information, or SAI. Mutual funds, open-end, as well as closed-end funds, are required to have a Statement of Additional Information, or SAI, available for delivery within 3 business days of an investor's request without charge. Investors can obtain a copy by calling or writing to the investment company, via a company website, contacting a broker that sells the investment company shares, or contacting the Securities Exchange Commission, or SEC. While a prospectus is always sufficient for the purpose of selling shares, some investors may seek additional information not found in the prospectus. This additional information is not considered mandatory to make an informed investment decision, but may be useful to the investor. The SAI affords the fund an opportunity to have expanded discussions on matters such as the fund's history and policies. It will also typically contain the fund's consolidated financial statements, including the balance sheet, statement of operations, an income statement, and a portfolio list at the time the SAI was compiled. Following is a summary for mutual fund disclosure. The summary prospectus conforms to Rule 498, a short form that may be used to make the sale. It contains the summary of key information in the prospectus and is presented prior to or with the solicitation. The prospectus, statutory, is a sale document that contains full and fair disclosure of all material facts for investment decision. It is presented prior to or with solicitation, or if a summary prospectus is used, no later than confirmation of the sale. The statement of additional information is intended to present more data for the investor. It contains additional details about the fund not necessary for the prospectus. It is presented within 3 business days of customer request. Disclosures. The SEC requires a fund company to include additional disclosures in its prospectus or annual reports. Intended to enhance and align with making full disclosure, they include a discussion of factors and strategies that materially affect its performance during its most recently completed fiscal year, a line graph comparing its performance to that of an appropriate broad-based securities market index, and the names and titles of the persons primarily responsible for the fund portfolio's day-to-day management. Financial reports. The Investment Company Act of 1940 requires that shareholders receive financial reports at least semi-annually. One of these must be an audited annual report. The reports must contain the investment company's balance sheet, a valuation of all securities in the investment company's portfolio as of the date of the balance sheet, a portfolio list, the investment company's income statement, a complete statement of all compensation paid to the board of directors and to the advisory board, and a statement of the total dollar amount of securities purchased and sold during the period. Take note, an investment company must send a copy of its balance sheet to any shareholder who requests one in writing between semi-annual reports. Fund costs and fees. The services mutual funds offer may include retirement account custodianship, investment plans, check writing privileges, transfers by telephone or online, withdrawal plans, and a number of other services and privileges. However, an investor should always weigh the cost of services provided, as the costs are ultimately passed on to the investor, against the value of the services to the investor. Sales loads, management fees, and operating expenses reduce investor returns because they reduce the amount of money available for the fund to invest. Sales loads. Discussed earlier, funds can charge sales loads in different ways: front-end, A shares, back-end, B shares, or level load, C shares, sales charges. Though most fund companies charge far less, they are permitted to charge up to 8.5% of the money invested for A shares. B shares charge the sales charge when the money is withdrawn. In both cases, the percentage sales charge compensates the sales force, the broker-dealers and underwriters who market and sell the shares to the public. Expenses. Like any business, fund companies incur a number of expenses to operate the business. Among them are operating expenses. Typical expenses would be salaries and administrative fees. Fund portfolio management fee. Paid to those hired to manage the investments in the fund portfolio, it is calculated as a percentage of assets under management. Take note, the management fee is every fund's single greatest expense. Charged annually, the fee is a percentage of the total assets under management. 12B1 Asset-Based Fee. Section 12B1 of the Investment Company Act of 1940 permits a mutual fund to collect a fee for promoting, selling, or undertaking activity in connection with the distribution of its shares. The fee is determined annually as a flat dollar amount or as a percentage of the fund's average total NAV during the year and is charged quarterly. The fee must be disclosed in the fund's prospectus. Typically, these 12B1 fees are associated with no-load fund companies. However, if the fee is more than 0.25% of the average net assets, the fund may not use the term no-load to describe itself. Finally, as a way for investors to compare one fund's expense charges to another, a simple ratio known as the expense ratio can be used. A fund's expense ratio compares the management fees and operating expenses, including any 12B1 fees, with the fund's net assets. All mutual funds, both load and no load, have expense ratios. The expense ratio is calculated by dividing a fund's expenses by its average net assets. Example: an expense ratio of 1.72%. means that the fund charges $1.72 per year for every $100 invested. Stock or equity funds generally have expense ratios between 1 and 1.5% of a fund's average net assets. Typically, more aggressive funds, Perhaps those employing more sophisticated or risky investment strategies have higher expense ratios. For bond or debt funds, the ratio is typically between 0.5 and 1%, a bit lower than stock funds. Non-U.S. market securities. Some funds invest either in part or exclusively in the securities of companies that have their principal business activities outside of the United States. While there is no limit to what their objectives can be, most are structured for long-term capital appreciation. Generally, the advantage for an investor is the ability to add worldwide diversification to one's investment portfolio, but there are risks. Whenever investing in securities issued in non-U.S. markets, investors need to be sensitive to the different risks that might apply to foreign investments. While the funds themselves are U.S. securities and would be considered to be liquid and so on, the securities in the fund portfolio wouldn't be U.S. securities. Those securities within the portfolio could be subject to political forces, currency risk, and liquidity risk, all of which would be discussed later in this unit. 2.1.5 Direct Participation Programs, or DPPs. Direct participation programs, DPPs, are unique forms of business that raise money to invest in real estate, oil and gas, equipment leasing, and other similar business ventures. DPPs are not taxed directly as a corporation would be. Instead, the income or losses are passed directly through to the owners of the partnership, the investors. The investors are then individually responsible for satisfying any tax consequences. There is virtually no secondary market for an investor to divest interest in a DPP, and in this regard, they are considered highly illiquid and therefore, on the point of liquidity alone, not suitable for many investors. 2.1.5.1 Types of DPPs. Following are the most common types of programs. Each is a unique form of business with different investment objectives and benefits. Real estate programs. Real estate programs can invest in raw land, new construction, or existing properties. Depending on the properties held by the program, they can provide investors with the following benefit opportunities: capital growth potential, achieved through appreciation of property; cash flow or income, collected from rents; tax deductions, from mortgage interest expense and depreciation allowances for wearing out the building and capital improvements; tax credits, for government-assisted housing and historic rehabilitation. Tax credits are very strong incentives as they reduce tax liability dollar for dollar. Oil and gas programs. Oil and gas programs include speculative or exploratory, wildcatting programs to locate new oil deposits, generally considered the riskiest developmental programs that drill near existing producing wells in the hopes of locating new deposits, and income programs that invest in producing wells, generally considered the least risky. Unique tax advantages associated with these programs include the following: intangible drilling costs, IDCs. These are costs associated with drilling, such as wages, supplies, fuel, and insurance, that have no salvage value when the program ends. These IDCs can be written off or deducted in full in the first year of operation. In contrast, tangible drilling costs are associated with items that have some salvage value at the end of the program, such as drilling equipment. These types of tangible costs, instead of being immediately deductible, are instead deductible over several years. The deduction is taken as depreciation. In other words, each year the asset is worth a little less, and that depreciation amount can now be deducted. Depletion allowances. Tax deductions that compensate the program for the decreasing supply of oil or gas or any other resource or mineral after it is taken out of the ground and sold. Leasing programs. Equipment leasing programs are created when DPPs purchase equipment leased to other businesses. This type of equipment can be as far-ranging as jetliners or rail cars leased to airlines and railroads, trucks leased to shipping companies, or computers leased to any business in need of them. Investors receive income from lease payments and also a proportional share of write-offs from operating expenses, interest expense, and depreciation of the actual equipment owned by the program. The primary investment objective of these programs is tax-sheltered income, the income being sheltered by the write-offs. 2.1.5.2. Limited partnerships. The most common type of DPP in the securities industry is a limited partnership, or LP. LPs are investment opportunities that permit the economic consequences of a business to flow or pass through to investors. The business themselves are not tax-paying entities. These programs pass through to investors a share in the income, gains, losses, deductions, and tax credits of the business entity. The investors or partners would then have the responsibility to report individually to the IRS. The greatest disadvantage to limited partners is the lack of liquidity in the partnership interest. The secondary market for limited partnership interests is extremely limited. Investors who wish to sell their interests frequently cannot locate buyers, that is, interest in the business is not freely transferable. 2.1.5.3. Investors in a limited partnership, tenants in common. A limited partnership involves two types of partners, the general partner, or GP, and the limited partners, LPs. A limited partnership must have at least one of each. Property in these partnerships is usually held in the form of a tenant in common, or TIC, which provides limited liability and no management responsibilities for the limited partners. General partners. General partners have unlimited liability, meaning that they can be held personally liable for business losses and debts. Their role is to manage all aspects of the partnership and have a fiduciary responsibility to use the invested capital in the best interest of the investors. In managing the partnership, they make decisions that legally bind the partnership, buy and sell property for the partnership, and are compensated for fulfilling these duties. They may not compete personally with the business, borrow money from the partnership, or commingle the partnership funds with their own personal assets. Limited partners. As their title implies, limited partners have limited liability, meaning that they can't lose more than they invested. They have no business management responsibilities, and in fact, should they participate in any day-to-day management of the business, they can lose their limited liability status and be considered a general partner. LPs have the right to vote on overall business objectives and the right to receive cash distributions, capital gains, and tax deductions generated by the business. They have the right to inspect all books and records, and if the GP does not act in the best interest of the business, LPs have the right to sue the GP. Limited partners enjoy several advantages. An investment managed by others, the general partner. Limited liability, can only lose the amount invested. And flow-through of income and certain expenses. Partnership sales and dissolutions. LPs may be sold through private placements or public offerings. If sold privately, investors receive a private placement memorandum for disclosure. Generally, such private placements involve a small group of limited partners, each contributing a large sum of money. The investors must be accredited investors, meeting income and net worth criteria, and must have substantial investment experience. The general public generally does not meet this description. In a public offering, limited partnerships are sold by prospectus for disclosure. In a public offering distribution, a larger number of limited partners, each making a relatively small capital contribution, $1,000 to $5,000 is more likely because they do not need to be accredited investors. Generally, limited partnerships are liquidated on a predetermined date specified in the partnership agreement. Early shutdown may occur if the partnership sells or disposes of its assets, or if a decision is made to dissolve the partnership by the limited partners holding a majority interest. When dissolution occurs, the general partner must settle accounts in the following order: secured lenders, other creditors, limited partners, first for their claims to shares of profits and then for their claims to a return of contributed capital, and finally general partners. 2.1.6. Real Estate Investment Trusts, or REITs. A real estate investment trust, or REIT, is a company that manages a portfolio of real estate, mortgages, or both, to earn profits for shareholders. REITs pool capital in a manner similar to an investment company, but are not investment companies, neither open or closed-end. Shareholders receive dividends from investment income or capital gains distributions. REITs normally own commercial property, equity REITs, own mortgages on commercial property, mortgage REITs, or do both, hybrid REITs. REITs are organized as trusts in which investors buy shares or certificates of beneficial interest, either on stock exchanges or in the over-the-counter market. Under the guidelines of Subchapter M of the Internal Revenue Code, a REIT can avoid being taxed as a corporation by receiving 75% or more of its income from real estate and distributing 90% or more of its net investment income to its shareholders. 2.1.6.1. Registered versus non-registered REITs. Many REITs are registered with the SEC and therefore subject to all disclosure requirements. These are known as public REITs. However, there are REITs that are not registered with the SEC, known as private REITs. Non-registered REITs are not subject to the same disclosure requirements as public REITs and therefore subject to greater risk. 2.1.6.2. Listed versus non-listed REITs. Many REITs are traded on a stock exchange. These are known as exchange-traded or listed REITs. For those that are not listed on an exchange and trade instead in the OTC market, unique risks exist. Not being exchange-traded, they can be difficult to price and possibly illiquid. Test topic alert. The following are five important points to remember about REITs. An owner of REITs holds an undivided interest in a pool of real estate investments. REITs may or may not be registered, public or private, with the SEC. REITs may or may not be listed or trade on exchanges. REITs are not investment companies, open or closed-end. And REITs offer dividends and gains to investors, but do not pass through losses like limited partnerships, and therefore are not considered to be direct participation programs, or DPPs. 2.1.7. Hedge funds. Many companies rely on one of the exceptions from the definition of being an investment company under the Investment Company Act of 1940. They are not classified as face amount certificate companies, unit investment trusts, or management companies, open or closed end. These companies are commonly known as private investment companies. Some private investment companies can be what are known as hedge funds. Test topic alert. Hedge funds are considered unregulated, as they currently do not have to be registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. 2.1.7.1. Basic structure and characteristics. Hedge funds are similar to mutual funds in that investments are pooled and professionally managed, but they differ in that the fund has more flexibility in the investment strategies employed. While hedging is the practice of attempting to limit risk, most hedge funds specify generating high returns as their primary investment objective. In attempting to achieve these returns, they tend to shoulder a substantial amount of risk. Aggressively managed portfolios of investments, hedge funds utilize advanced and sometimes complicated investment strategies. In this light, these investment vehicles are generally considered suitable for sophisticated investors only, those meeting specific income and net worth criteria, and those who are known as accredited investors. Take note, while hedge funds are unregulated, U.S. laws do require that investors meet the test of being a sophisticated investor. This means they should be considered accredited investors, having a minimum annual income and net worth, as well as considerable investment knowledge. Some of the more common strategies employed by hedge funds are highly leveraged portfolios, borrowing to purchase securities, the use of short positions, selling securities the portfolio does not own, the utilization of derivative products such as options and futures, currency speculation, commodity speculation, and the investment in politically unstable international markets. Most hedge funds are organized as private investment partnerships, allowing them to limit the number of investors or require large initial or minimum investments if they so desire. Some also require that investors maintain the investment for a minimum length of time, for example, 1 year, and to that extent they can be considered illiquid. These minimum holding requirements are known as lockup provisions. Take note, it is not unusual for hedge fund organizers to also be investors in the fund. 2.1.8 Exchange-traded products, ETPs. Exchange-traded products, ETPs, are securities that trade intraday on a national securities exchange and are priced so the value of the product is derived from other investment instruments, such as commodity, a currency, a share price, or an interest rate. Generally, these types of products are benchmarked to stocks, commodities, or indices. They can be actively or passively managed portfolios. Following are two common ETPs. 2.1.8.1 Exchange-traded funds, or ETFs. This type of fund, considered an equity security, invests in a specific group of stocks and generally does so to mimic a particular index, such as the S&P 500. In this way, an ETF is similar to a mutual fund that tracks an index. The difference is that the exchange-traded fund trades like a stock on the floor of an exchange, and in regards to how it trades, is similar to a closed-end investment company rather than an open-end mutual fund. They are registered, however, as either an open-end fund or as a unit investment trust, or UIT, but are obviously different in many ways. Because of the way they trade, an investor can take advantage of intraday price changes due to normal market forces, rather than just the underlying value of the stocks in the portfolio. And, unlike mutual funds, ETFs can be purchased on margin and sold short. Expenses tend to be lower than those of mutual funds, and the management fee is low as well. Consider that the portfolio is designed to track an index, and just as the securities contained in the index are unlikely to change, so are the securities in the fund portfolio. In other words, there is little trading activity required to keep the fund's securities aligned with those in the index it is intended to track. This generally results in greater tax efficiency for the investor. On the other hand, every time a person purchases or sells shares, there is a commission, and those charges can add up over a period of time. Understanding that exchange-traded fund or ETF shares are not mutual fund shares, but are registered as open-end funds, it should be expected and is common that they are often compared to mutual fund shares. In that light, exchange-traded funds have some advantages and disadvantages to be considered when compared to open-end or mutual funds. Following are some of the advantages of exchange-traded funds when compared to open-end or mutual funds. Pricing and ease of trading. Since individual ETF shares are traded on exchanges, they can be bought or sold any time during the trading day at the price they are currently trading at, as opposed to mutual funds, which use forward pricing and are generally priced once at the end of the trading day. Margin. ETFs can be bought and sold short on margin, like other exchange-traded products. Mutual funds cannot be bought on margin, nor can they be sold short. Operating costs. ETFs traditionally have operating costs and expenses that are lower than most mutual funds. Tax efficiency. ETFs can and sometimes do distribute capital gains to shareholders like mutual funds do, but this is rare. Understanding that these capital gains distributions are not likely, there are no further tax consequences with ETF shares until investors sell their shares. This may be the single greatest advantage associated with ETFs. Following are some disadvantages of exchange-traded funds when compared to open-end mutual funds. Commissions. The purchase or sale of ETF shares is a commissionable transaction. The commissions paid can erode the low expense advantage of ETFs. This would have the greatest impact when trading in and out of ETF shares frequently, or when investing smaller sums of money. Overtrading. Given the ability to trade in and out of ETFs easily, the temptation to do so is possible. Excessive trading can eliminate the advantages associated with investing in a diversified portfolio and add to overall commissions being paid by the investor, further eroding any of the other expense and operating cost advantages associated with ETFs. Market influences on price. Because ETFs trade on exchanges, share prices can be influenced by market forces such as supply and demand, like any other exchange-traded product. In this light, investors need to recognize that just as they might receive less than book value per share when selling corporate shares of stock, they might also receive less than NAV per share when selling ETF shares. 2.1.8.2 Exchange-traded notes, or ETNs. Exchange-traded notes, ETNs, are senior unsecured debt securities issued by a bank or financial institution. Therefore, they are backed only by the good faith and credit of the issuer. The notes track the performance of a particular market index, but do not represent ownership in a pool of securities the way share ownership of a fund does. ETNs are bond-like instruments with a stated maturity date, but they do not pay interest and offer no principal protection. Instead, ETN investors receive a cash payment linked to the performance of the underlying index minus management fees when the note matures. While the market price of an ETN in theory depends on the performance of the underlying index or benchmark, the ETN has an additional risk compared to an ETF. If the credit of the underwriting bank should falter, the note might lose value in the same way any other senior debt of the issuer would. Additionally, there are limits to the size of ETN issues. This means, with limited availability, there are times when an ETN might trade at a premium to its inherent valuation. Investors purchasing at a premium could be subject to losses later, depending on the value of the note at maturity. Quick Quiz 2.C. Learning Objectives. Compare the characteristics of different investment products. 1. All of the following could be found in the money market except A. T-bonds maturing in 12 months, B. T-bills, C. commercial paper, D. equities such as common and preferred shares. 2. The most common type of direct participation program in the securities industry is A. a limited partnership, B. a REIT, C. a CMO, D. an investment company. 3. All of the following are benefits for the limited partners in a direct participation program, or DPP, except A. passive losses, B, flow through of income. C, unlimited liability. D, an investment managed by the GP. 4. A pooled investment which is organized as a trust in which investors buy shares or certificates of beneficial interest, either on stock exchanges or in the over-the-counter market, is A, an investment company, B, a REIT, C, a CMO, D, a DPP. 5. An open-end management company may charge what amount annually and still advertise itself as a no-load company? A, 8.5%, B, 2.5%, C, 1.25%, D, 0.25%. 6. All of the following are true for exchange-traded funds or ETFs except A, ETFs can be bought or sold throughout the trading day. B, ETFs are not marginable securities. C, ETF share prices are subject to market forces like supply and demand. D, ETF transactions are commissionable trades. 7. An investment established by states to provide other government entities, such as cities or counties, a place to invest funds short-term is an A, FDIC, B, ABLE, C, LGIP, D, REPO. 8. Regarding annuity products offered by insurance companies, which of the following is true? A. Variable annuities are securities, fixed annuities are not. B. Fixed annuities are securities, variable annuities are not. C. Neither variable nor fixed annuities are securities. D. Both variable and fixed annuities are securities. 9. A private, unregulated investment company organized in such a way so as to invest and achieve high returns utilizing debt leverage and derivative products such as options and margin is best described as a mutual fund, b, direct participation program or DPP, c, real estate investment trust or REIT, d, hedge fund. 10. An investor has placed money in a debt-like instrument issued by a financial institution and linked to the performance of the S&P 500 index. From the investment, which has a stated maturity date but makes no interest payments, the investor anticipates receiving a cash payment minus any applicable management fees when the instrument matures. This describes which of the following investments: A. Mutual bond, B, direct participation program or DPP, C, exchange traded note, ETN, or D, variable annuity or VA.